Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Why are you following me?
The stuff you wear isn't appropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. And none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching. We are who we are. I am Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you were just joining us here for the first time, what we do on this podcast is Richard and I pick a show that is currently airing and we watch it one episode at a time and we talk about it. And as I just mentioned, we are currently covering HBO's We Are Who We Are from Luca Guadagnino. We are on episode 3, so we will be discussing everything up through episode 3. We will not be proceeding past that because I believe Richard and I still have not watched past the current episode. So we are fresh eyes on all of this. You can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We actually got a couple emails this week, which is fun because Richard and I like both were sort of like, is anyone gonna want to like talk to us about the show? Is anyone gonna like, you know, we're used to people writing in like theories and stuff like that, but we got some great emails this week, so thank you guys so much. So yeah, before we get into the discussion of the episode, let's just hit these emails really quickly. This first one comes from Ian, and we had talked last week about, I'll just read Ian's email. He says, I was interested by Joanna's reflection on how she tended to romanticize Italy because of British authors who had done the same. It reminded me of a title on the subject I came across when I worked on the book review section of an academic journal, The Warm South, How the Mediterranean Shaped the British Imagination, which is a book that is readily available to, you know, if you want to, where you buy your books, you can go buy this book. It is written by Robert Holland, and you know, and so it's just I'll just like read a little bit of a description about it. Ever since the age of the Grand Tour in the 18th century, the Mediterranean has had a significant pull for Britons, including many painters and poets who sought from it the inspiration, beauty, and fulfillment that evaded them at home, referred to as magic land by one traveler. Dreams about the Mediterranean and responses to it went on to shape the culture of a nation. Written by one of the world's leading historians of the Mediterranean, this book charts how a new sensibility arose from British engagement with the Mediterranean, ancient and modern, ranging from Byron's poetry to Damien Hirst's installations. Robert Holland shows that while idealized visions and aspirations often met with disillusionment and frustration, the Mediterranean also offered a notably insular society the chance to enrich itself through an imagined world of color, carnival, and sensual self-discovery. So I'm like, I think that, you know, that theme really comes to bear in this episode because we get like a literal street party, a carnival sort of thing, where, you know, you kind of get the sense that people are as almost like, you know, in a Shakespeare, you know, like I'm thinking like Midsummer Night's Dream or something like that, where people like their baser instincts or emotions sort of come burbling out in a setting like this one in this episode. Richard, is that connection seem far-fetched? What do you think about that?
No, I think that makes sense. I think there are a couple certainly interludes in this episode that do have that kind of, you know, night of magic, kind of Midsummer Night Dream kind of thing, to the sense that that everything is closer to the surface of, you know, feeling. And we see that in ways both, I guess, somewhat joyful, but a lot of anger in this episode.
A lot of rage. Yeah,
which I think has something to do with when the show is set, which we can get into. But yeah, that book sounds fascinating, and I think would be something to an interesting line to trace from, you know, the Grand Tour era to things as recent as Under the Tuscan Sun and Mamma Mia and, you know, things that romanticize right. the Mediterranean in Tuscany isn't exactly, I mean, it's close, you know, in ways that feel maybe a little fresher, but also kind of are still doing the same thing.
Yeah, and also that sort of like white tourism of like Eat, Pray, Love or whatever. Under the Tuscan Sun is similar, sort of like, you know, white lady finds herself sort of thing, which I, you know, listen, white ladies deserve emotional awakenings too. It's just like, yeah, they always, it seems like they're always going to a piazza to do so. So
and these stories never seem to bring any of that feeling back to America. You know, it's right. never like, hey, look, these people have like, I mean, obviously Italy is mired in economic problems, so is Greece, but like, you know, the sense of like, well, maybe there's more to life than like working and, you know, right. things that I feel like Europeans in general with better vacation time and better maternity leaves and things like that are just, you know, people enjoy them to go visit them or have one person go live off the fantasy life there. But we don't tend to bring the ethos back home.
I think, yeah, that's a really good point. And like to your point that you made last week sort of about these army kids and the life that they're experiencing. I mean, this episode starts with sort of Harper talking about sort of almost object impermanence. The idea of like, why would you care for a thing if as an army kid, you're just going to pull up, you know, stakes and move at any given time. So why would things be something you invest in, you know?
Right.
All right. So we also got this email from Chris about the music, which we mentioned a bit last week. So thanks for speaking about the music featured in the show. I have absolutely nothing to do with it, but I've been a huge fan of Luca's use of music since Call Me By Your Name. Unsurprisingly, Luca works with Robin Erdang quite often, and there is a bit of a musical overlap between Call Me By Your Name and We Are Who We Are. The first being 80s Euro music. The first piece used at the beginning of episode 2 is by Klaus Nomi, an experimental German artist from the 80s. They both also feature pieces by John Adams, So Does I Am Love. He made Hallelujah Junction, which starts Call Me By Your Name. I Was Looking at the Ceiling and Then I Saw the Sky, which starts episode 1 of We Are Who We Are, and the piano song we hear while Harper's on the bus. Also interesting to note that the song Harper is listening to while in bed is by Young M.A., who is one of the very few well-known queer rappers, a very masculine lesbian. I found most of the songs used on the show via a men's health article that's being updated weekly. So if you go to menshealth.com, they have like ongoing updated soundtrack list. And then Chris compiled what he could find into a Spotify playlist. So if you go to Spotify and look for We Are Who We Are playlist by Chris Molina, M-O-L-I-N-A, you will find an updating list of the soundtrack. If you want to like bring that... the sun is way too hot, I have a headache feeling into your offices or your homes, there's a playlist for you.
So. Yeah, you know, paint your bedroom wall a sort of earthy, stucco-y orange, and yeah. I don't know, open the windows while you still can, and put on that soundtrack, and you know, it's almost like actually traveling.
Yeah, it's just the same. It'll be fine. So yeah, so those are emails. Thank you both so much. And you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Love your feedback. Love your insight. I want to start off this episode by talking about, we talked about how the first two episodes are two two episodes rooted very much in point of view, right? We start with Frasier's point of view. We get Harper's point of view on almost similar events. This episode, I would not say has a singular point of view, but what comes to the fore, I think is a compelling portrait of Sarah, which is Chloe Sevigny's character. So I kind of wanted to start with Sarah, who is a really interesting, scary, compelling figure. And like, I guess, you don't get to be commander of a base if you're not someone who, enjoys power, and enjoys like some manner of manipulation. But the way we see Sarah traverse, this dinner, after dinner sex with her partner, and then how she treats her assistant, who she may or may not know is an object of interest for her son, at, you know, at this festival, is interesting to me. What, like, you know, what stood out for you, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this episode, the way that it focuses, I mean, it focuses on a lot of characters, which I like that the show is kind of broadening its purview a little bit, past the first two, which were, you know, in certain POVs. But the way that it kind of juxtaposes, Richard, so the other army parent,
yeah, right.
And Sarah is, you know, that all of the order of the military, of course, affects everything about career service people's lives, but that there is, as there is with anyone, really, a vast interiority to their life beyond that ordered world. And even something as seemingly cloistered and rigid as living on base, there's obviously this, you know, deep well of individuality and difference, and I think it's interesting to get these two glimpses of how these parents use their free time, when they're not, you know, in service of this greater ideal, so to speak. And neither are good in this episode in some ways.
No. Yeah.
I would say that Sarah, you know, she's dealing with, we see further complications with Frasier's emotional stability, let's say, and how she reacts to that. And you wonder if some of the rest of the way that she conducts, you know, conducts herself has to do with it sort of needing a release from that stress, which is totally understandable. You know, whereas I think that, Richard's character is, we see like a really angry side of him this that, you know, I don't think that Guadagnino or anyone involved in the show is arguing that these are two sides of the same coin or whatever, like that they are, that these are related necessarily. But I think in this episode that is all about, you know, blowing off steam and what comes out when you do that. It's interesting to look at these two people who are so dedicated to, something larger than themselves, as they see it, struggling with their own interior lives and, you know, realities.
Well, it's interesting to me that, like, Sarah, there's this line in the episode where probably Sam, who's the one who broke up with Harper in this episode, says something like, she always needs to be the center of the tension or something like that when Harper's just walking down the street minding their own business, right? But I think that that applies to Sarah. I mean, like, obviously, like, Frasier seems like a very challenging kid to raise. But, like, Sarah is doing something that I've seen from narcissistic parents in the past, which is, like, competing with her son. When she says, don't be jealous just because she likes me, about Harper. Later in dancing with her sister. I mean, we don't know that she knows that Frasier has any sort of connection with her assistant, but it still just feels like I need to be desired or be the most, the shiniest thing in the room for everyone. You know what I mean? Does that seem fair?
Yeah. I mean, not to sound creepy or whatever, but like that character who's, what's his name? The major,
Jonathan, Tom Mercier. Yeah.
You know, he's this seemingly sweet hunk, you know, he's like hot and maybe a little dopey in a cute way. Interested in literature, you know, he's not like dumb, but he just has this kind of guileless quality about him.
Yeah.
And in a world that is, you know, I was thinking about this when Sam breaks up with Harper, and it's like, okay, what does he do now? Like, who else does he date? I guess he could go meet an Italian girl who doesn't live on the base, but like, you know, options are somewhat limited for not just like actual romantic entanglements, but like that kind of energy.
Yeah.
And Jonathan is clearly in the show's aesthetic and language is putting out that kind of available, intriguing sexual energy, whether or not Sarah is aware of how that's affecting her son or not. But it clearly was sort of a moth to a flame sort of thing, while also having the complicated dynamic of that he's, you know, he's her assistant essentially, and so there's that in play. But I think also just the way that the show has positioned Jonathan on the base and in the kind of flow of these people's, you know, their traffic through the base and outside the base, like he's clearly looming large for people in some way, she had to seemingly tap into that, you know.
That moment, you know, when we see Fraser see her before we see what he's looking at, though we can like pretty quickly figure it out. And you have to think about the like the triple layer of transgression that's happening here, right? Because it's like his crush, number one, even if he's not quite prepared to admit that, right? His crush, number one, her employee, her subordinate, number two, and the dance is the kind of dance that if I were Maggie, I would not be stoked to see Sarah, you know, doing that, you know, especially in public. So, you know, maybe like a marital transgression. I don't know their arrangement, but like maybe. And so, I just think it's so interesting to have a character like this. Chloe Sevigny is perfect person to play a character like this, but I have a character like this, and I just don't think we usually see women play a character like this, so powerful and so in need of powerful in a different way than we often see women be powerful. Power in a more, you know, militaristic, aggressive, I want to have sex after a terrible argument with my son in the kitchen kind of thing.
And not just a terrible argument with her son in the kitchen, but also the follow-up conversation she has with Maggie, where she maybe accidentally at first, but then lets kind of sit there and sink in a mean way, this whole thing about Fraser not being Maggie's biological child, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of nastiness that passes between them, or it's really one, it's in one direction.
Yeah.
And yet then there's still the sort of sex afterward, you know. But I think as much as that's a really interesting characterization of Sarah, and Sevigny is so good at those subtle modulations, you know, is also that like there is a bit of empathy at work there too, in that like it's showing us some similarities between Sarah and Fraser, in that like they're both in their own ways impulsive and seemingly driven by sort of emotional whims that maybe they don't feel they have control over, or that they don't realize have these sort of destructive ripples, you know, affecting those around them. And so as much as they're two very difficult characters, increasingly difficult, I think in Fraser's case, like, there's an understanding, I guess, that's being extended. And right. I'm curious to see how that develops, because this episode was difficult in a lot of ways. I sort of, you know, I was watching it with my boyfriend and we were both just sort of like, everyone's horrible. so many people are so mean in this episode. Like, and I think sometimes that can be a disconnect with how certain filmmakers in Europe in particular, like, their sensibilities about like tact and kindness are sometimes represented differently on film than they are than people, you know, from Americans and the way that we think of you know, character interaction. So I have to get over that sort of alienation. But I think there's also a deeper thing, more specific to the show, which is about people who are not only chafing against their circumstances, but like in that chafing are sort of irritating each other and everyone around them, you know?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Maggie, because I want to talk about that. I mean, like, I feel like, to your point, I feel like every time we cut in the back half of the episode, every time we cut to like Maggie and Jenny, you're like, oh, two nice people talking to each other.
Right. Yeah.
What a relief. When we first started podcasting about this show a couple weeks ago, and you were like, yeah, I'm not sure of that dynamic. Like, Fraser seems like he's Sarah's kid. I'm not sure, like, you know, where exactly Maggie fits in. And we find in this episode that like Maggie met Sarah when she was like so newly pregnant she wasn't even showing yet. So like Maggie has been there from the start, and so there's no reason other than this mean possessiveness, as I diagnose it, on Sarah's part, for Maggie to not be entirely also Fraser's mother. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that just seems like a power dynamic that's been held in the household of like, you're not the real mom. And it's not something that like Fraser seems to hold her to, but something that Sarah, I would imagine this is not the first time that Sarah, this seems like something Sarah would say all the time. Like my son, not our son, right?
Well, and I think we see also that Sarah has some resentment toward the fact that Fraser does go to Maggie for certain things, you know, and for like more like, more sort of like everyday easier counsel on things like pick me up from this thing. I'm stranded or whatever. And I think that it's not an accident that when we see this dynamic, when this family, you know, sort of more deeply illustrated in this episode than we have before, we also have that brief scene, between, Jenny and Richard, where he's like, I wonder who's like the man in that relationship.
Oh,
like usually,
right.
You know, and while I think we are to understand that as like an example of Richard's sort of bigotry that is more being teased out, there also is a reality, not on gender lines, certainly, but a reality that like in any parenting, you know, twosome, there are going to be different dynamics, but you know, like certain people are going to fulfill different roles, and clearly, Sarah looms large in the sort of more dramatic emotional capacity of Fraser's life, but Maggie, maybe it's less appreciated, clearly offers a really necessary ballast to that. And,
yeah, I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
And I think that, like, the frustration that both she and Jenny very gently kind of were circling in their scenes in this episode speaks to that. It's like, we are, like, the rocks of these households, and yet we are not the ones that anyone turns to when they're having, you know, the big feels, really, you know?
Right. And I think it's really clever, then, that there's a scene in this episode where, you know, Fraser is teaching Harper to shave, which is something that we saw Maggie, like, repeating this lesson that Maggie taught him in episode one. And, you know, just like the way in which Maggie models good, caring behavior for him, that, you know, doesn't necessarily, like, I think when we see him do something good and kind and caring, it feels like it's, you know, this is behavior learned from Maggie, and the out of control rage and stuff like that, you know, might be behavioral, but it also, that comes from, you know, Sarah. And once again, not to be too Richard about it, by Richard, I mean the fictional Kid Cudi Richard, like, those are, you know, traits we would associate with, like, usually with like a father figure and a mother figure, you know what I mean? And so, like, I really like, and I like, you know, like, Sarah's got the big important job. Like, if they move, they're moving for Sarah's job. And not that being a nurse isn't a big important job, but like, you know, that that's the truth. Like, no matter, you know, this whole family revolves around moving for Sarah's career. And once again, that's just not something I'm even used to seeing modeled in like lesbian relationships on in film and television, where it's like they're so clearly an alpha. I'm sure it has, you know, I haven't watched The L Word, so I'm not going to like speak to, there's plenty of like gay, you know, film and television that I haven't watched, so I can't like speak to it broadly. But it just feels like an interesting dynamic to explore here, you know.
It is interesting dynamic, and I think also narratively speaking, I really appreciated the Jenny and Maggie scenes, because I think a lot of times when you have stories about, you know, the domineering partner, the one that who, around whom the rest of the family orbits and follows right. into wherever, you see characters, oftentimes it's a wife, have this sudden realization of like how much of themselves they've ceded away to this kind of family project.
Yeah.
And yet in this, it's clear that this has been on Maggie and in a different way, Jenny's mind for a long time. And so they're meeting each other sort of in medias res and just saying like, yeah, these are things that we think about and that concern us. I don't think that we're meant to read any of that conversation as epiphany or an indication that they're either are about to leave their partners. It's just like, yeah, this is like one of the realities. Obviously there are other reasons why we stick around, but like, I just appreciated the way that it kind of peeks in on this and this complicated dynamic, this complicated relationship, and doesn't try to, I guess like turn anyone's head in like a new direction. It's not saying, well, if only they realized how cloistered, how like stifled their life has been. It's like, no, like they already know that, you know? But it's part of this kind of bigger compromise of like, coupling. I mean, they are who they are, you know, and I think that right. they are, right. if not 100% content in that, at least, assured of it, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, and one of the ways that that comes through in Jenny's case, is this cultural erasure when she talks about like, you mm-hmm. know, they only want me to make American food. She's carrying around, an apple pie, even though she calls it a cake. It's very confusing for like part of the episode. You know, as American as apple pie, you know what I mean? And the fact that Maggie is there to be like, hey, I see you. You're Nigerian. Like, oh, do you make this dish? Oh, I've had it. I liked it. You know, sort of thing. Like, yeah, it's not epiphany, but it's an I see you in a way for each other yeah. that they don't get in their own houses often, which I really I want for them and I like for them. So.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
And I think that brings us to another major facet of this episode as I see it, which is it's in its kind of slightly opaque, maybe allegorical way, it's really digging into the Americanness of the story and when this is taking place, like in the lead up to Trump's first election, yeah. Is we see in different facets, like in these conversations with Brazilian Maggie and Nigerian Jenny, in the fight with the Italian people after they lose a tug of war, or, you know, whatever, right. like, right. like the totalizing of like American aggression and identity and how it just seeks to subsume everything else around it, will not brook any difference. That's obviously not true of all of America, nor is it true of all Americans or whatever. But like, I think in the way that this show is positioning itself, in relation to American politics of 2016 and now, it's saying something pretty, I think, potent and sharp about, the way that Americans seem to just bulldoze through the world and assume that everyone's going to kind of fall in lockstep behind them or, you know, face worse, you know, consequences. Yeah. And then you see just a generation removed from that, these kids who have kind of, at least as particularly in Harper's case, grown up floating all around the world. And so don't have that particular national allegiance. I mean, you were talking about the object permanence thing, and how they're really caught between these identities, which, you know, then so interestingly is in conversation with their sexual and gender identities. And I think that, you know, and then the title of the show, it's like, you know, the only constant is there is them and their bodies and their minds. But even those aren't necessarily constant. And I think it's a really interesting way for, you know, a European writer director, his European co-writers, his cast of, you know, they're an African woman and a Brazilian woman, and, you know, to look at American identity, through their perspective.
Yeah, no, I think that's really smart. And something that I really love in this episode is this, like, you could easily have, this thing where Richard has this like game he participates in every year, and it's important for him that he wins, and it's important for him that his daughter be there to see him, and it's important for him, you know, even though he rejected in the end, it's important that, you know, Jenny be there with the pie cake or whatever, you know. And that could have easily been like a base thing, but the fact that it was a Pioggia thing, and that the fact that it was like an ancient seeming traditional thing, like to see Richard in this, like, in a hose and a tunic, and participating in, you know, is like a local traditional game, it added this element of needing to conquer. Like, I don't need to just win the games. I need to win your game. This is your tradition, but I'm here, and I'm gonna participate in it, and I'm gonna beat you at it. Is sort of Richard's attitude. At least that was my read on it. You know?
Yeah, totally. And then when they lost on someone else's turf,
yeah,
and were sulking over their pizza and beer, it took what, one Italian to make fun of a really noxious sentiment, which is America first,
right?
For a brawl to break out. It's the fragility and the sensitivity of this supposed America. I mean, not supposed. I mean, America is mighty in that it can do great harm to many people around the world and in its own country. You know, this kind of almost pathetic, like, oh, really, man? Like, really? This, like, just let it be, you know? But they can't. And it's partly because they are being inculcated by the culture of the military and of a certain kind of occupation. I mean, you know, there is an American base in a foreign country. And I think that thinking of it through that lens and about what, you know, and what's about to happen in America and the world, it frames what Harper and Frasier are sort of grasping at, or starting to grasp at, or starting to realize they want to grasp at something. It frames it a little sadly, I think, because in some ways, while their lives are going to continue on and in whatever permutations they take, they are going to get swallowed up in this bigger thing, like everyone is, you know. And I find something a little sort of forlorn about that idea.
I want to talk about that. I'll really quickly mention, just to agree with you, that like when Jenny is like, oh my gosh, I have to show up with this pie, I'm like, in my head, I'm like, Richard's so fragile. Like, Richard's so fragile if his wife doesn't show up with a pie. And then also, Richard's so fragile that his daughter didn't show up. And it's like, I have empathy for parents who, like, have a close relationship with a child and that child shows up and they need them less. But, like, are you really going to sulk over your pizza about this? Like, she, you know, your child is a teen. They are doing their own thing now. Like, I don't know. It's, I don't mean to not have empathy for that experience. It just, like, it was interesting to see, because the rage that I suspect is there within Richard, which we saw, you know, when he got upset about the boat and stuff like that, like the rage that's there. It was so interesting to see his stillness compare, like, in contrast to that rage that was breaking out in the brawl behind him. So that was like, because there's a different approach where you could have him get involved in that brawl, and you could see that brawl as a way for him to work through his anger and hurt that he's feeling around Harper not being there. But, like, instead, he's just sitting still against it, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and then to contrast that with Danny, his son, who, like, attacks both his sister and verbally and then Fraser physically.
Right.
Because he's upset that his dad quit the basketball game to discipline his sister, you know, and like he's upset that seemingly this new kid has come maybe usurping his father's desired position in the base, but also just like disrupting this like little social group. You know, it's that that anger is inherited, certainly.
All right. So let us talk about the Hillary Clinton cameo in this episode. This, you know, as we mentioned, the like the Trump Clinton election is the backdrop, the political backdrop, at least of this episode or the series. We see, I believe it's the DNC, like Clinton's speech at the DNC, and Bernie Sanders sort of like tepidly clapping for her. And then Sarah says this thing where she says, my type, but not my kind, which I thought was really fascinating because I tried to parse it like 9 different ways. What was your read on that reaction?
I don't really know. I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of this show is challenging my like character analysis, I think, because they're behaving in ways that don't really follow trusted patterns of like characterization from like American writers. What did you make of it?
I think my parsing of it is my type being like, I mean, if we want to describe Hillary Clinton this way, and I don't see it as an insult, like a ball busting lady, but not my kind, meaning I suspect Sarah is a registered Republican voter. That's what I think.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, like so many in the military, you know?
Yeah. So my, you know, my type in that, like, I'd like to root for this woman who has had to be tough in many different ways, you know, however you want to define tough, in order to get where she is. But I'm, you know, I don't agree with the liberal agenda here. I think that's what it is, unless it's the opposite and it's like I'm a Democrat but not like that. I don't know, but I would really suspect Sarah's a Republican. Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. And did you have any larger like Clinton Trump thoughts beyond what you already expressed in this episode?
Just a minor feeling of how, I mean, granted, how almost pathetic the little Clinton snippet plays. I mean, knowing what was about to happen and just knowing how her brand of things and sort of mainstream Democratic politics, like, just seems so ineffectual in this world, you know, on this base. Like, what the fuck did that mean? You know, whereas Trump, like him or hate him, was saying something loud enough for these people to pay attention, you know. I'm not in any way praising Trump, but you know, it's just this Hillary thing, and it's just, you know, cute little Jonathan alone in the office.
Oh, I know.
You know, and it's like, oh, so sweet. But then you kind of think, then you kind of turn toward the TV and you're like, oh, so sweet. You know, it's like, it just feels so diminutive in a way. And I have no doubt that part of that is gender. But the juxtaposition between that moment and the Trump election stuff looming so much bigger in an earlier episode, I think is not an accident.
Yeah, like the tiny screen versus the huge outdoor like movie screen. That's good.
Can I just say, by the way, speaking of Jonathan, I'm just taking a gander at Tom Mercier's Instagram. It's a delight.
Oh, great. Oh, good to know. Yeah. I mean, like, I would listen to him talk about Ocean Wong like any day of the week. Oh, so yeah. That, I'm really thrilled. Yeah.
That moment when, you know, there's that sweet thing where he's like, he has a novel coming out. It's, you know, and that was a big book. That was on the towel of many like Fire Island selfies, you know, like it was on the
even,
beach towel.
Even
behind.
I read it. Yeah.
But that moment was really cute. But then when Jonathan leaves and Fraser has this like reaction where he's just like, wait, does that mean he might be, you know, like, it's just, it's very sweet. And I think, was a really great bit of acting, from young Mr. Grazer.
Yeah. Also, I knew it was you. I knew it was you who had the book. Like, that's just like a, it's another like Maggie Jenny, I see you sort of moment, which is nice. But I, yeah, I, so with the Clinton thing, I want to talk about the treatment of Harper in this episode, which just gives me like, you know, Clinton-esque acid flashbacks in terms of like how much Harper is being blamed for things that Harper has nothing to do with in this episode by her friend group. Like, being blamed for breaking up the friend group, being blamed, you know, how could you break up with him when Sam broke up with Harper? And then at one point, like at the parade, when Brittany calls Harper across the like path of the parade and Harper comes over, and then like Brittany's like, oh, I'm sorry, she's being a bitch. I was like, oh, what do you mean she's being, you know, they're being a bitch? Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's not uncommon for this to happen, to, you know, Harper is considering their gender right now to young women, to young presenting as women, people being blamed for nothing, doing nothing, you know?
Well, I think that's an interesting thing about this show, which is, you know, you and I and other audience members might come in with our preconceived ideas of like, oh, it's Italy, it's going to be so progressive. And I mean, I know that Italy has, you know, we know that intellectually, but like, it's a dreamy show set in Europe. Like, oh, that'll be so like, everyone's going to be so freewheeling and, you know, amorous and whatever. And then partly because of the American presence, but also just partly because this is the story they're telling, all of these like really hardwired bad things start clanging against all of what we wish would just be, you know, this free expression, which I would have to imagine was the intention, was, you know, I gave you some version, melancholy as it might have been, of the, you know, falling in love as a queer teen thing in Call by Your Name, and now here is a more modern, perhaps more realistic look at what that kind of exploration actually feels like and functions as.
Yeah. You know, and I want to talk about that, you know, so if Call Me By Your Name is considered like an awakening for Elio, like, you know, we're witnessing a similar thing here with Harper in terms of an awakening of the possibility of gender expression. And, you know, for all that Frasier is an out of control, you know, force around Sarah, he's so tender with Harper, and the things, you know, like showing Harper photos of trans folks and talking about the possibilities there, and watching Harper, you know, like experiment with shaving cream on their lip or like feeling their like, you know, their breasts and being like, do I want this? What do I want? I could be wrong, but I haven't seen a lot of slow storytelling around someone, you know, awakening to the idea of being trans. I've seen cinema and television about already trans people, trans teens. But I don't know about awakening. Am I missing something big? Does this feel like a little different? What do you think, Richard?
Well, I haven't seen the everything about this topic, you know. Right. But yeah, from what I've seen, I think that for me the big difference is compared to a film like Girl, the Belgian film that won a bunch of awards at Cannes, and then Netflix bought it, and then it premiered in the U.S. and everyone was like, "What the fuck is this movie?" Because I think in some cases, which is weird to say about America, American discourse about trans issues actually does feel a little bit more advanced than that of like Western Europe's. I can't speak to the rest of the world. Obviously, there are many different, you know, philosophies and whatever about all this that go back into history and, you know, but, you know, I think about what's happening with, a certain strain of British feminism right now, which has really been bad. And, you know, but anyway, that movie Girl, like, it focused so intently on the body stuff and particularly genitalia, in a way that, to hear a lot of trans writers and, activist who spoke out against the film really was not only unfair and kind of prurient in its gaze, it wasn't made by a trans person. It also was really reductive about what that experience can be, you know, in terms of, yes, obviously body stuff is involved, but it's something more holistic, more complicated. And I really like the way that this show, and maybe if we have, you know, people who know better than I, you know, who disagree, please let us know. But like, to me, it seems it's being done a bit more slowly and kind of, you know, more empathetically and just sort of feels more organic, I guess. I mean, we'll see what's yet to come, but I like the way that it's being meted out both carefully and casually, I guess, which is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. It reminded me of something that you said to me like years and years and years ago, and I forget which podcast, where you were talking about, you know, I want to see more gay narratives that aren't like, oh my gosh, I'm coming, it's my coming out narrative. I want to see more like about young kids, teens or whatever. Like, I want to see more like, I'm already out, now what sort of thing, which I think we're getting more of. This was, as I said, several years ago. And you were like, I've seen the Love, Simon or the whatever, you know, like I want something a little different. And so then I was thinking of like, maybe the opposite is kind of true of the trans narrative, where we've seen a lot of like, you know, like Euphoria or other things where like, not a lot, but we've seen some things where like the decision is already made. Or I don't know if that's an inaccurate terminology, but like, the process has already begun or something like that. You know what I mean? And Harper is right at the beginning of something. And that is a really compelling to watch.
Yeah. I think it's compelling to watch. And it's also, as much as I think there is a sense of political doom looming around this show, like kind of stalking the edges of the show, I think also, in that sweet scene in Fraser's bedroom, which, by the way, you know, has a Klaus Nomi poster on it. And I think it's an Italian poster for Blue Velvet. So, I mean, that's Gluka being like, eh, I like those things. you know, like, here is the 1% that's good about the internet, you know, like, oh, they can look up this stuff and feel that they are part of, you know, not, I'm not saying that Harper identifies as part of any community, but like, see that that's out, that is out there. And in this weird island, essentially, that they live in or on, that the bigger world is waiting for both of them in whatever form that they want to be, you know. And again, I think there you have the title of the show coming to bear on things where it's like, you know, R is present tense, but like, that's the present is always the present, you know. So like, I am what I am today, but I'm maybe not what I was yesterday, but yesterday I was what I am, you know. You know, like, it's this kind of like logical thing. But yeah, I don't know. I find it hopeful. I find it tentative in a way that feels realistic. I find it, I hope that the show doesn't take some, you know.
Oh, I know.
Dark turn, whatever.
Good work so far. Please don't disappoint me. Yeah, and this idea of we are who we are, and how we aren't who we are. No, but like the Maggie Jenny stuff, it's like they're army wives, sure. But then they share this moment where they're talking about like, here are the ways in which we are something beyond being our powerful spouses, partners. You know what I mean? And like, Danny asks Craig, who's Sam's older brother, do you ever feel like you don't fit in? And Craig is like, I'm in the army, bro. Like, that's when we just fit. We just fit in. Here's where we fit in. Here's our tribal identity. And we all fit here in these boxes. And so we're watching characters like Danny and Harper and Fraser, like really like wilding out of those boxes. You know what I mean? Danny, I'm very worried about Danny, but I hope the best for him and he figures something out. To be met with, like, to express suicidal ideation to your friend and have them be like, oh, beat the shit out of you, you ever say that again, you're like, it's not, get this boy some therapy, I beg of you. But that's yeah, that, you know, I think this is just a really fascinating exercise in, like, expression against the backdrop of, well, the other thing about you often find with gay narratives, it's there was that great tweet about I forget who did it, about the two lesbian romance films that are at the film festivals this year, where someone was like, I think it was Alex Adbet, I'm not sure, but he was like, get the lesbians, like, fax machines and Wi-Fi. Like, basically, let's take these gay narratives out of period pieces and bring them into modernity. But I think a reason why gay love stories in period pieces are so irresistible to a certain kind of filmmaker is that it's like, oh, it's forbidden, the rigidity of the society. So instead of, like, setting it in the distant past, we're setting in our gender, sexual awakening on an army base in the Trump election year. That's where the and even with a lesbian woman at the head of the base, there are some rigid structures in place here. So we'll see what we see, you know.
Yeah, and it's two traditions, American military tradition and Italian cultural tradition, crashing into each other, you know. And I think that this episode illustrates that in a really strange way and an interesting way. And as the most plot heavy episode we've gotten so far, like, it does feel like the show is now, you know, all the wheels are turning now, which is
excellent.
Interesting.
Well, Richard, until we come back to talk about episode 4, where can folks find you?
Well, it's tug of war season. So I'm in practice. Well, we call it rehearsals, but I'm in rehearsals probably 4 days a week. And then on the weekends, I'm traveling to a lot of different tug of war competitions, which is really exciting. You know, I trained for this all year. So I'll be doing that. In the meantime, when I'm not, you know, in rehearsals, I will be tweeting at Rylaws and writing reviews and things on VFTech.com. Joanna, until we head back to the base next week, where will you be?
VFTech.com. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, but mostly we'll see you guys next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.